The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we are looking at an innovative new technique for linking the people who have the bright digital ideas with the people who have the cash. The Startup Shuttle takes networking along the rail lines from London to Edinburgh. We'll be finding out how to climb aboard the Opportunity Express. Keith Stewart is at the launch of the next game in the Call of Duty franchise, a series that has taken more than $1 billion. Joining me in the studio are Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish from The Guardian. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there are only a handful of games and films to have ever taken more than $1 billion. What do you think they are?
The Goonies?
So Jemima thinks that one of them is The Goonies.
I wish it was
Titanic.
Junk.
Huh? Titanic must be one of the Titanic, the film. Must have taken more than $1 billion.
See this, I'm giving you
Avatar.
Nothing.
Avatar.
I'm giving you nothing, people.
I think Avatar hasn't been going long enough to collect the billion yet.
So you're trying to figure out if you've got them right. I'm not going to tell you. Throw an idea of a game.
Halo. The Halo franchise, World of Warcraft franchise.
Jemima, what's your
sort of cumulative
Tetris?
Star Wars franchise. Do you sort of count the Star Wars franchise as...
Snakes on a plane?
Hold your horses.
Gold bullion on a plane?
Hold that glorious, glorious thought, because this is what's known
Print
in the business.
Print your inkjet cartridges on a plane?
We'll be doing the reveal later. So listeners, dear listeners, if you want to play along at home, then have a think about which of the handful of film and games have made more than $1 billion. That's a US billion, by the way, but more than $1 billion US dollars.
No cheating, no using
definitely
Google.
Definitely.
Other search engines.
We will also be discussing the implications of the closure of LimeWire, the peer-to-peer file-sharing technology taken to court this week. Plus more, there is so much more, over the next half an hour. So keep listening to The Guardian. We start with this week's news. First, file-sharing technology LimeWire was served with an injunction in a federal court this week, that's a U.S. federal court, by the Recording Industry of America, the RIAA. The technology, which allows users to search peer-to-peer networks for movie, music, and other digital files, has been battling with the RIAA for over 4 years over supporting copyright infringement activities. The injunction, however, has stopped the distribution of the latest version of the software. Previous versions are still functional. Now, Jemima, what is the latest on this story?
This case has been going on for 4 years, so it didn't exactly come out of the blue. The court said it had caused a massive scale of infringement and issued a permanent injunction against the site. So let's just look at the stats for a minute. 150 million users, 58% of P2P sharing, downloading music, so you have to assume most of that is... illegal. And according to the Record Industry Associated in America, US recorded music sales fell $7.7 billion in 2009 from $14.5 billion in 1999. And how much of that is down to, if not LimeWire specifically, then P2P services? Discuss.
Well, what is interesting is that The Economist says... That Will Page of PRS thinks that the UK music business grew 5% in that time from 2008 to 2009. So clearly, you know, obviously statistics, you can read statistics, you know, a bit like tea leaves. And, you know, that does suggest that, in fact, that peer-to-peer networks and file sharing, Charles, are not contributing to the death, the doom of the industry.
But I think that's the music industry in the whole, in the round, so that's including takings from concerts and so on. And I don't know if you've been trying to buy any gig, you know, tickets to any big gigs or even in some of the festivals. They're really expensive. And PRS, of course, is also going to be doing licensing in music. So there's sort of use in films, there's use in ringtones, all those sorts of things. All the little subsidiary things that didn't used to be so big, those have grown.
This just simply suggests that it just simply needs a new business model. I can't really imagine that this is going to stop peer-to-peer file sharing.
Of course it won't. I mean, this is... a business protecting its business model, and they have to be seen to go out there and act against people that are openly infringing their business models. But it's not, in the long term, a very clever thing to do, because people will just move on and have moved on to alternatives that we won't mention here. But the short-sightedness of the record industry, I mean, it's kind of an easy target to pick on, but I was having a conversation with somebody just this morning about this, who had spoken to a very senior executive, very well known, who hadn't heard of a BitTorrent, didn't actually know what a torrent was, which is just astonishing. And arguably, record labels could, perhaps should, have gone out and invested in this technology and tried experimenting distributing their music in this way.
Well, there are loads of people within the record companies who do know all about it. I mean, I was talking to people 10 years ago, you know, when Napster was the only sort of game in town and the file share in town, and they all knew about it. They were talking about possibilities. I mean, I did actually talk to the American Publishers Association, and they were saying, Napster, we think it's great. If we could hook up with Napster so that every time a file gets shared, we get a cut of it, you know, Napster moves to a paid-for model, that's great. They could see that as a potential model. Record labels wouldn't wear it. But the reality is that, I mean, if we just imagine, what if all the file-sharing networks just stopped altogether, you know, for some reason, you know, a bit like the day the Earth stood still, they just stopped happening. Do we really think that everyone who at present is file-sharing would suddenly say, God damn, not file-sharing is not working, I'm going to go and buy the records instead? Don't think that would happen. I mean, you might see a sort of a gradual movement back towards buying a bit more, but you know, the record companies themselves also accept that there wouldn't be a sudden, you know, enormous explosion of people buying records. They know that every, you know, it's something like perhaps one in every 20 tracks is the sort of thing someone might have paid for. But the disappearance of P2P wouldn't mean a huge growth in the record industry.
Well, we'll talk more about this, and you can read up on this and other similar stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, I've always been quite critical of the way that National Rail present their train times. I have had some amusing situations in the past with their voice recognition software directing me to, oh, God only knows where, practically the moon. So I've actually been thrilled when new apps and services started to make sense of these cluttered and quite chaotic timetables in a way that made sense and was actually useful to me. Jemima, you recommended one that was called traintimes.org.uk, which is a fantastic service. However, that service and other ones that used the API that was published on the official Rail site, well, National Rail have begun to enforce the license that these APIs fall under, thus cutting off the many services that have historically relied upon it, even if they're not commercial. Charles, why have they decided now to enforce these licenses? Because frankly, I'm annoyed.
Well, it's not to annoy you. I've actually been trying to get some clarification from National Rail and from the Association of Train Operating Companies. They haven't come back to me on this. But, you know, the person who found out about it is Alex Hewson, who's a developer who wrote a free UK Train Times app and found that suddenly he was getting requests from National Rail, first of all, to have a web token to access the API, which is quite common. Lots of services will say, you know, you've got to have a token. It's basically a sort of identification. So it says, you know, I am this person. Here's my login name. Here's a unique key that belongs to me. Now can I access your API? Basically, it lets them see who's using how much. And if you're throttling, if you're just going mad, or if your service is somehow turn into a runaway, can just block it. But National Rail wrote to Houston and said, well, actually, the service that we provided for free, you should have always had a license for it. And he said, well, you didn't used to require a license. And they said, well, we do now, and we're probably going to start charging for it. None of which anyone can quite understand, and National Rail and ATOC haven't come back about it.
Now, that's National Rail, Charles. But Jemima, TfL, Transport for London, did a similar thing. I believe it was in October last month.
Yeah, similar chaos about 10 days ago, I think, when Malcolm Barclay is a developer who similarly realised that the API he'd been using had been switched off. And I spoke to another developer about this, not Malcolm, who characterised it as you can either create your own API, which is quite expensive and, well, complicated and fiddly. You can use an unofficial API that developers sort of found out about and had been using. And I think that's what Malcolm did, actually. Or you can use the official API, but that hasn't been released yet. So what you have is quite a few really good apps using the unofficial API. And TfL, for whatever reason, decided to switch that off, and hence the chaos. Whether they will introduce a license or not when it comes to the official API, we don't know.
I'm assuming that all of this has to do with money. This isn't some kind of like profound thing that they want to have control over in the future, and they're going to roll something out that's going to be absolutely amazing and you know, take our breath away.
My understanding is that TfL turned off there was a specific XML feed for the API which Malcolm Barclay was accessing. They turned that off because they discovered a security weakness in it which could have been used to bring the site down. They decided that because so much of the rest of TfL depends on the site working, they had to turn that off because they figured, well, that's the least harm. But I think it's also coming back on pretty much imminently. As for whether there'll be a charge for it, my understanding is that there's a very, very strong instruction from the top and all round the sides as well. They're not going to charge for it. They're not going to charge for data. They're not going to build their own apps either. They're going to leave that to the developer ecosystem so people can do their own apps. They can charge for them. They can not charge for them. They can do adverts, whatever they want. Because the whole idea of the London Data Store making data free is all very much ingrained now in the whole way that the London authority is working.
And, of course, a National Rail, this coming back to the National Rail, wasn't this in all the data that was pledged to be opened up by the government?
Well, it's tricky because ATOC and National Rail they're not owned by the government. National Rail is, in effect, a private company. So, in my queries to National Rail and ATOC, I have sort of said, you know, everyone benefits if you make this data free.
Well, finally, in this week's news, there's been a change of personnel at the top of the stack at Google. Several of the developers who founded the Silicon Valley giant's most popular services, Maps, AdMob for mobile phones, and YouTube, have found the exit door in the last week. And the most recent, Lars Rasmussen, who came up with Google Maps during the company's 20% innovation time policy and is the idea smith behind the now defunct Google Wave, he is the most recent departure, citing that the size of Google has become too unwieldy for his liking. In an interview with the Sunday Herald last weekend, Lars Rasmussen said that he would be joining Facebook in San Francisco, leaving Sydney for the warm embrace of Digital Media Central. Charles, so many people are leaving Google. Why? What gives?
It's not got quite the same buzz as it used to have a few years ago. It's not the sort of the place that people leave Microsoft to go to. A lot of the buzz is with Facebook. You know, people are going from Google to Facebook because it's a smaller company. It's got the startup vibe. It's growing fast. Whereas Google sort of feels like the comfy slippers of the internet. You know, it's sort of big, and it's not going to get big. You know, it's not going to really grow very fast. So the places where things are happening in Google at the moment is really around Android, and possibly around the Chrome operating system, and a little bit around the Chrome browser, but a lot of the rest of it. Google Wave just didn't take off, and I think Rasmussen said that they didn't give it enough time to catch on, but I don't think Google Wave ever would have caught on the way he wanted.
I've kept a bit of an eye on Chad Hurley because he is one of a small number of techies who went to art school, as I did, and so I've sort of kept a bit of an eye on him. Like Biz Stone at Twitter, incidentally. And he made $334 million when Google bought YouTube, personally.
That's not bad for an artist,
is it? It's not bad, is it? So there is hope for us all yet. I'm sort of interested in what he was going to go on and do next. I mean, he's invested in Formula One, and he put some money behind Halaska, which is like a guy's e-commerce site. But he only had to stay at YouTube for 18 months after that deal in 2006. And he stayed, you know, more than four years. So it can't be that bad.
Do you think, though, that that there is a kind of mental shift? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we were speaking about the games business. This idea that these companies, they start out starry-eyed entrepreneurs, have this brilliant idea, suddenly the scale happens and they've got 26,000 people around the world.
Yeah, and how you keep innovation going in that environment is a massive challenge to these companies. I mean, Facebook undoubtedly has the advantage in that it's kind of the cool kid on the block now. And look at the valuations that it's generating now. It's a massively exciting place to be, and I think anyone who has the skills and can charge, you know, the odds because they're a talented developer is going to want to go there. But that's not to underestimate the enormous power of Google and the amount of talent that they still have there. Yahoo, incidentally, tried to encourage innovation by setting up Brickhouse, which was to work as an exciting kind of startup wing, and Tom Coates, among other people, worked there. But they ultimately felt that didn't really work in their environment, and even that became a bit staid. So what is it that drives people on? I think motivation comes down to a lot of things. It's a lot of things for a lot of different people.
You can read more information on all this, this week's tech news, at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, before we move on, next week we're going to be recording a program in Bradford at the Bradford Animation Festival at the National Media Museum, which is soon to have an internet wing. Keith Stewart will be in the hot seat talking games with Charles Cecil of Revolution Software, comic author Kieran Gillen, and games artist and university lecturer Dan Pinchbeck. So do go along and ask questions. Tickets are free. Yes, they are free. And you can find out how you can get one on this week's program page at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, or it's technology. You can click the link that's on your iPod screen.
Click it now.
Click,
it's magic.
Click the internet. Magic. Click the internet. You can hear that program in 2 weeks' time. And on the 23rd of November, we're packing it all into the end of the year. On the 23rd of November, Web to Ireland is kindly hosting the program in Dublin. Charles and Jemima will be meeting the great and the good of Dublin's tech scene, finding out about standout startups and projects that deserve some special attention. If you or someone you know is technologically awesome and in Dublin, then do come along and tell us. Again, there are details on this week's program page or on your iPod screen now. This week, the latest in the massively successful computer games franchise, Call of Duty, was launched to the gaming press. The first and third-person military action strategy game has courted controversy over the cast list, the choice of good guys and bad guys. But despite, or perhaps because of this, it's sold over 55 million units worldwide. And as we said at the outset of the podcast, it's made over $1 billion. Keith Stewart is at the 2-day launch event.
A lie is a lie. Just because they write it down and call it history doesn't make it the truth. We live in a world where seeing is not believing. Where only a few know what really happened.
Ready when you are. I'm here with David Vonderhaar from Treyarch, the developers of Call of Duty Black Ops. David, can you tell us just a little bit about the game, introduce what it's about?
Yeah, so we tell a story in the era of the Cold War. What war was going on in the Cold War, and it was conceivably a bunch of black operations that you don't really know about. You know, and we like to say, just because they wrote it down doesn't make it so. So what was really going on during this period of time? So we take you all over the world. There's some aspects of it in Vietnam. You're behind enemy lines in the Soviet Union. You end up in Cuba. You end up in Kowloon City in China. So we're globetrotting, but it's not a World War II game. And, the time period, is late 60s, early 70s-ish, but you have to see the game to kind of understand the time, how the time frame works out.
You've researched it quite thoroughly, haven't you? I know you have a kind of Call of Duty military advisor, but you've also looked into other aspects like the Russian Spetsnaz troopers and things like that, and have you done a lot of sort of reading around the Cold War as a company to sort of get ideas and concepts?
Yeah, I mean, I have a bookshelf full of reference material from, technical manuals of Huey helicopters from the Vietnam era all the way up to, really great stories. Major John Plaster was one of the many military consultants. He's written several books on this topic about the SOG, the SOG, and how they were a division of the CIA and operating in Laos and Cambodia where they're not supposed to be, recently declassified stuff. And there's a little, just amazingly great reference material for the time period that just a lot of people don't know about. So it's a really great opportunity to tell these stories in an area that you don't hear much about.
Mm-hmm.
Multiplayer is obviously a big element of the Call of Duty series, and it's your area really within the game. You're the director of multiplayer, I believe. What can you add to that whole experience now? The formats of multiplayer have been so sort of strictly defined over the last few years: death matches, team death matches. We all know the kind of modes. What have you been able to sort of add to multiplayer in Black Ops that we might not have seen before?
There's the wager match game mode. Those are four brand new free-for-all game modes where you're actually gambling money, what we call the COD points and the currency system. On the simplest front, we have a mode called combat training, and if people are not necessarily multiplayer gamers, they can come over and play combat training by themselves or with a friend without necessarily having to fight online with, you know, really pretty good multiplayer gamers, so they can get practice and experience.
Yeah, I love the idea of the combat training, because to a lot of players who come into these kind of quite mainstream games like Modern Warfare, you enjoy the single-player experience and you go online and you're immediately subjected to these amazingly talented people. So I guess that's part of your job as well, to make sure that everyone gets a really kind of nice, comfortable experience with multiplayer in the game.
Our team is on a mission in life to convert everyone to be multiplayer gamers, right? Because it's a really fun experience. It's pretty important to give those players a chance to beat the crap out of some practice dummies or AI opponents first, get some confidence, and then they can go and you know, wrestle it out in the real world.
Okay. There's a zombie co-op mode in this game. And I believe that, I know there was a zombie co-op mode in your last game, Call of Duty World at War, and I believe that kind of came about almost as a programmer tested it. Was it ever meant to go in the game, but it just became massively popular? Can you tell me the story of how zombies got into sort of a World at War game?
You know, there was a designer who zombies was a, you know, I don't know, pet project might be the wrong word for it, but certainly an experiment. But a lot of really fun ideas come out of the most unusual places. You can't necessarily plan them 2 years in advance. You start messing with concepts, you start practicing and trying different techniques, and you stumble into something, and it just took off. I mean, it was instantly fun internally when we were looking at it, and it just spiraled, and the whole studio kind of rallied behind it. And yeah, it was not a planned mode at all.
And the game also supports 3D as well. Have you played in 3D? And if so, what do you feel it adds to the experience?
Well, I have played in 3D, and it's a completely game-changing experience. I think people who are shooter fans in particular are going to be really impressed by the depth of field that you get, you know, looking through the 3D scopes and, you know, being able to target up on people. And we're going to sell 3D TVs. It's that good.
And now wait a few moments, let him rest. This should help you remember everything. When he regains consciousness, double the voltage. We need to bring him back.
I'm interested in where you see the first-person shooter going in the future, because we've seen, obviously, Black Ops. It looks staggering, you know, visually. We saw Medal of Honor, which had some very kind of realistic elements in it. Lots of kind of documentary feel to first-person shooters now. Lots of shaky cam and sort of granular effects, things like that. What can we kind of expect from Call of Duty in the future? I mean, are we talking like, you know, better AI, more amazing graphics effects? Where is this whole genre going, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of places we'd like it to go, of course. On the multiplayer side, you know, we're just dipping our toes in what it means to have a, you know, Creative Class came on board a couple games ago, and we've been trying to tweak that formula ever since. We've added the personalization side. There's just one small aspect of a game where that character is going to take on this kind of persistent life, and maybe he can live not just this game, but future games, right? So I think that genre bleed where you become a personality, you take on the role of that personality, you're equipping yourself, you're, you know, deciding to tattoo your face if that's what you're into. You know, that to me, and having that live beyond multiple games is a really good place to go. And, you know, that's just one. There are several examples like that.
Okay, so in the future we could have like one soldier that we're responsible for throughout the whole sort of Call of Duty world, maybe.
Yeah, why not, right? I mean, it's a really great thing that we could do. I mean, you don't want people who play multiplayer, they don't play for 6 to 8 hours and then put it down. I mean, they play for, the investment of time will boggle your mind, right? It's mind-bogglingly large amount of investment. So if you're going to put that much investment, then some persistence around that character and having him survive and then, you know, bringing new content for him to go explore and getting that attachment, that's a big deal for shooters. Other games have been doing it. Why can't first-person shooters do it?
That was Keith Stewart at the Call of Duty launch event. The latest game, Call of Duty Black Ops, is released on the 9th of November. One of the major problems for many people with bright ideas in the digital space is getting to the people who can help to fund them. Now, in the UK, there are a few hubs of digital innovation, quite a few actually, primarily in London, Brighton, Bristol, Manchester, and Edinburgh, and of course other places as well. And a small pool of British VCs naturally gravitate towards those locations. And of course, there you can have hack days and meetups. And, you know, it's great because you do get the chance to connect and to network. But what about the rest of the clever boys and girls around the country who don't want to or can't move to one of these locations? How on earth can they get their feet on the entrepreneurial ladder? Well, SD Chaikin believes that she has the answer. She and her team want to use the train link between London and Edinburgh as a moving networking and knowledge transfer meeting location once or twice a month, collecting people along the way who need advice and connecting them with passengers who can give it in the 5 hours it takes to get between the two cities. They've even approached Virgin CEO Richard Branson to donate a train trip. Jemima met with ST to find out more, and she began by asking why, given the number of hack days and incubators and meetups and all that kind of thing already happening around the country, why do it on a train?
We found that there actually is a divide in the startup ecosystem. A lot happens in London, and a lot happens in Edinburgh and different cities and the likes, but really we want to connect that ingenuity, that entrepreneurship altogether, mobilize it. And what way to better do it? Well, up on a train in 2 days, really all these other events take place maybe 2 hours. So it's giving that flexibility to different startups to meet, to network, and to get their idea across the country easily.
So you'd be able to get on the train at Newcastle and then stay on until Edinburgh?
Yes.
But
yes.
This would be a train that would be going backwards and forwards over 2 days constantly.
Yes. So you can pick when you want to get on. And actually the schedule of events is quite loose. What we wanted to do is get 3 carriages at most and basically make different carriages set with different themes. So one carriage could be a product presentation for the startup. Another carriage could be pitch your business to investors, and the third carriage could actually have students come on board, fresh talent right off the bat, to connect with recruiters and to connect with the other entrepreneurs.
Okay, so who is on board so far?
Well, we have actually a couple of interested people from the likes of Microsoft BizSpark and actually IBM's Global Entrepreneurs and Academic Program. They have expressed interest. And these are big businesses with big ideas. They kind of understand that there's a small startup community out there, or budding startup community, and how can they tap into it? Even though they're bigger organizations, they know that the ideas come from the bottom.
And is this as well about expanding the discussion beyond what's going on in London? I mean, we took the Tech Weekly podcast to Newcastle and to Edinburgh, and there are very thriving, interesting communities out there. What sort of feedback have you had from those communities about the idea?
Edinburgh is really onto the whole idea. They are enthusiastic and ecstatic. I've actually used to live in Edinburgh, went to the University of Edinburgh. We've connected with Kate Ho, who actually has a blog called Startup Cafe in Edinburgh, and she comes out of the Department of Informatics as a graduate there. And just the enthusiasm has been amazing. From that, we went to Birmingham University and we started tapping in there. And just knowing that the universities are on board, I think that's first and foremost saying, yep, we have talent. We know we want to connect the talent to startups, and we have entrepreneurial-minded students.
The idea of attracting teenagers is really interesting. I think that's something that hasn't really been looked at much before. Occasionally at startup events or conferences, you have a panel of teenagers, and it's nearly always one of the most insightful panels.
Yeah.
So what are you hoping to do there?
This is an open platform, really, Startup Shuttle, and we don't want to discount any age range. And I think talent can start early as, you know, when you're 12, 13 years old. And kids especially influence the trends in tech and influence the trends in maybe social enterprise or wanting to do things for the greater good. So you need those ideas to come on board.
So you're looking for a big fat sponsor, basically.
That would be ideal. Yes.
Okay. And who are you talking to at the moment? Can you tell us, or is that Is that at a sensitive stage?
Well, it's a little bit sensitive, but at the same time, I'm happy to share that Virgin is our first point of call, and we're trying to do our best. But it doesn't have to necessarily be Virgin. What we're looking to do is talk to VCs, venture capitalists, talk to private equity companies and investors, because they want to widen their breadth of where they want to invest in their community. So there's some dialogue with incubation hubs that are actually there's a couple that are popping up around like the Thames River Valley and around Oxford. So we're actually tapping into those innovation hubs because that's where they want to bring the startups. So they need to start finding them. And they have the capital to do that, to invest in this project.
If you can't find a sponsor, are you just going to hire a coach in the style of a school trip out?
That's another way we're looking at it, yeah. I think it's just getting this off the ground. And once we do have that first event, I mean, the main way we're looking at it was a monthly two-day event. But if it's just a day on a bus, I mean, in the States, for example, there was a journey called the Startup Bus event that happened from San Francisco to South by Southwest.
We know it well.
Yeah, so it's, you know, tech and music. And what they did was they put all these entrepreneurs on the bus, gave them a challenge to come up with a business idea and almost a really high-level business plan once they got to South by Southwest. And it was all, it all happened. And actually on the bus, they were using all different social media, tweeting about it, attracting Facebook fans, things like that. So it's pretty much that concept. And then saying, we know we have interest from the community in London already, and Edinburgh, and just trialing it.
And if you can pull it off, when will the first one be?
We are hoping for November, for mid to late November. And that's really doing my darnest to get to get things started. We just have to bring in the resource and find the right context.
That was ST Chaikin from Startup Shuttle. And Jemima, can this work on a train? I mean, is this an appealing prospect?
There's no reason why it can't work on a train. I mean, if people want to give up X amount of hours to do networking, I don't see why it matters where it is. And actually, the concept of taking it outside London and picking up people en route is quite nice. So, yeah, they just need a big fat sponsor. And they're away.
How is this different, Charles, from other networking events, other than the fact that they can pick people up and drop them off?
Well, I guess you've got the sort of problem that you can't all just lurk on, you know, lie around on the floor and stuff. As much as anything.
That's what happens in networking events.
It does, yeah. You know. The fact that you're sort of stuck in a train by the, you know, you have to sort of have two people face each other, you know, tables of four, tables of two, all those sorts of things. I mean, it depends very much what sort of train it is. But, you know, I'm thinking of, the other problem I can see might happen a bit is your power sockets. You know, you've got to have people
Keeps
with lots
power
of
sockets,
power strips.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they might actually have to talk to each other.
Well, yeah, but it's the icebreaker at any hacking event, isn't it? It's just, I've got a power strip. You know, do you want to meet me?
Now, what I have in my head is not actually with the 2x2 and the 4x2 seating arrangements. I have. It's going to sound a little
don't
bit
think
dirty.
Of First Capital Connect.
I was thinking
doing it standing up.
Yeah,
I was thinking of the sleeper, actually.
Whoa,
the sleeper between King's
it's
Cross.
It's a whole
and
different
Edinburgh.
Kind of connecting
a whole
event.
Different
Alex.
Kind of network. Put your tickets in the bowl when you get on the train. But no, there's
you can't see this, but Alex is actually blushing.
I'm not part. Blushing, am I? Am I blushing? Oh, now I'm blushing. But no, there's a section in the sleeper which is like the dining car, and everybody sort of jumps in on the dining car, and it's like an open space, and you've got banquets around the side, and you can have your
short. Sorry, what are they around the side?
Bonket.
What's
so you make me blush again.
Is that a girl group?
It's a
what is that?
It's a banquet. What do you call it in
They're
this
like chaise longue, I think.
Thank you very much. At least
there
you
are chaise longues. Which trains have you been going?
Oh, I tell you, the sleeper.
Hey, I commute on from Brighton. You know, we don't. Maybe the Queen will lend us hers.
Well, yeah, that's true. She doesn't need it much.
Put
yeah.
Swan on the menu. Anyway, this has just gone completely off track. Yes,
it's a winner.
And when this train pulls out of the station, we will be on board. So we're waiting for the startup shuttle to depart. Oh, how far can I? How can I milk this? And when it does, we'll bring you what happens. That's all for this week's Tech Weekly. It's been grand. Next week, we'll be reporting from the many events taking place during Internet Week Europe, a festival of events taking place for digital thinkers, fanciers, and general geeks. So, of course, we'll be there. If you do see us at any of the events, do see the listings at internetweekeurope.com. Say hi, please, and introduce yourselves, because that is the weirdest thing. People just come up and say hi and then sort of nod expectantly. Just say your name. Just say your name, for God's sake. Finally, at the start of the podcast, we set you a challenge. Which games and films have made more than $1 billion? $1 billion. Like Call of Duty. And Jemima, you said The Goonies.
Snakes in a Plane.
Snakes in a Plane and Tetris. Charles, you said World of Warcraft, Avatar, and E.T., I believe.
No. Not Avatar, no. I said Titanic. Titanic and the Star Wars franchise, yeah.
Well, you're closer than Jemima, unsurprisingly. World of Warcraft, yes. Guitar Hero 3.
No.
Yeah.
I was so going to say that.
And Titanic, yes. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, just one of them. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, just one of them. Mm. Just one. And, I'm afraid to say, Avatar.
Titanic?
Get
Titanic,
on.
Oh yes.
Oh,
Titanic.
Right, right. Well, that's all right.
Well, that's
as long
fine.
As you got two one James right.
It's clearly no sign of quality, is it? But just saying.
It's all about the marketing. I don't know. I think that Guitar Hero 3 is pretty good. Anyway, this week's producer was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratosky. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.